This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Scourged by Kevin Hearn. Read for you by Luke Daniels.
The story so far. Atticus O'Sullivan, born in 83 BCE as Sheehan O'Sullivan, has spent much of his long life as a druid on the run from Angus Og, one of the Tuatha De Danann. Angus Og seeks the return of Fragora, a magical sword that Atticus stole in the 2nd century, and the fact that Atticus has learned how to keep himself young and won't simply die annoys the heck out of Angus Og. When Angus Og finds Atticus hiding in Tempe, Arizona, Atticus makes the fateful decision to fight instead of run, unwittingly setting off a chain of consequences that snowball on him despite his efforts to lie low. In Hounded, he gains an apprentice, Granuel McTiernan, retrieves a necklace that serves as a focus for Laksha Kulasekaran, an Indian witch, and discovers that his cold iron aura is proof against hellfire. He defeats Angus Og with an assist from the Morrigan, Briot, and a local pack of werewolves. However, he also severely cripples a witch's coven that wasn't exactly benevolent, but was protecting the Phoenix metro area from more menacing groups of predators. Hexed, Book 2, forces Atticus to deal with that, as a rival and much more deadly coven tries to take over the territory of the Sisters of the Three Auroras, and a group of Bakkens tries to establish a foothold in Scottsdale. Atticus cuts deals with Laksha Kulasekaran and Leif Helgerson, a vampire, to earn their help and rid the city of the threats. In Book 3, Hammered, the bills come due for those deals. Both Laksha and Leif want Atticus to go to Asgard and beard the Norse in their meat halls. Putting together a team of badasses, Atticus raids Asgard twice, despite warnings from the Morrigan and Jesus Christ that this would be a terrible idea, and it might be best not to keep his word. The carnage is epic, with heavy losses among the Aesir, including the Norns, Thor, and a crippled Odin. The death of the Norns, an aspect of fate, means the old prophecies regarding Ragnarok are now unchained, and Hel can begin to work with very little opposition from the Aesir. However, a strange coincidence with the Finnish hero Vainamirnin reminds Atticus of a different prophecy, one spoken by the sirens to Odysseus long ago, and he worries that 13 years hence the world will burn, perhaps in some altered form of Ragnarok. Feeling the heat for his shenanigans, and needing time to train his apprentice, Atticus fakes his own death with the help of Coyote in Book 4, Tricked! Hel does indeed make an appearance, thinking Atticus might like to join her on the dark side since he has killed so many Aesir, but she is brutally rebuffed. Atticus is betrayed by Leif Helgerson and narrowly escapes death at the hands of an ancient vampire named Zdenek, but ends the book with a modicum of assurance that he will be able to train Granuel in anonymity. In the novella Two Ravens and One Crow, Odin awakens from his long sleep and forges a truce of sorts with Atticus, enlisting the druid to take on Thor's role in Ragnarok, should it come to pass, and perhaps take care of another few things along the way. After 12 years of training, Granuel is ready to be bound to the earth. But in Book 5, Trapped, it seems as if the druid's enemies have been waiting for him to emerge. Atticus must deal with vampires, dark elves, fairies, and the Roman god Bacchus. And messing with one of the Olympians draws the attention of one of the world's oldest and most powerful pantheons. Once Granuel is a full druid, Atticus must run across Europe to avoid the bows of Diana and Artemis, who took exception to his treatment of Bacchus and the dryads of Olympus in Book 5. The Morrigan sacrifices herself to give Atticus a head start, and he is hunted in Book 6. Running and fighting his way past a coordinated attempt to bring him down, he makes it to England, where he can enlist the help of Hearn the Hunter and Flitish, the Irish goddess of the hunt. There he's able to defeat the Olympians and negotiate a fragile alliance against Hel and Loki. At the end of this volume, he discovers that his arch-druid was frozen in time in Tir na n'Og, and when he retrieves him, his old mentor is in as foul a mood as ever. In Shattered, Book 7, arch-druid Owen Kennedy finds a place among the Tempe Pack, and assists Atticus and Granuaile in thwarting a coup attempt in Tir na n'Og against Briot. Granuaile is sorely tested by Loki in India and is forever changed. And an emissary of the ancient vampire Theophilus strikes down one of Atticus's oldest friends. In the novella A Prelude to War, Atticus consults a tyromancer in Ethiopia to discover how best to strike back at the vampires, while Granuaile meets Loki for the second time. But this time, she's the one laying the ambush. Anxious to defeat Theophilus once and for all, Atticus teams up with Leif Helgerson to make sure the ancient evil is staked in Book 8. Granuaile learns that Loki is making deals with dark powers around the world and is consulting an unusual seer about when to begin Ragnarok. She teams up with Perun to defeat an old foe of his and deny Loki his foresight. Owen starts a new druid's grove in Flagstaff, receives a magical pair of brass knuckles from Cranya, and has a distressing encounter with a troll that goes poorly for both of them. The Treaty of Rome is established, wherein vampires agree to evacuate Poland and North America west of the Rocky Mountains. After the events have staked, Oberon and Atticus solve a couple of mysteries in and around Portland, detailed in the purloined poodle and the squirrel on the train, known together as Oberon's Meaty Mysteries. They befriend a man named Ernest Goggins Smythe, who winds up looking after the hounds while Atticus and Granuaile are out of town. And they also adopt a new doggy as a result of the investigations, a Boston Terrier named Starbuck. In Besieged, a collection of Iron Druid stories, we learn of several events that bear directly on the story to come. Flitish makes a woeful mistake by taking Pirun to a cuddle dungeon in Edinburgh. Granuaile must enforce the Treaty of Rome against some rogue vampires in Krakow, led by Kacper Gwova. The druids are called to Tasmania to save Tasmanian devils from extinction, and Owen's Grove participates. And Atticus learns from the Morrigan that Loki is about to begin Ragnarok, prompting him to tell Oberon the story of what happened to his Wolverine companion centuries ago. Also, along the way, there may have been some talk of poodles and sausages.
Chapter 1. I had a cup of wine with Galileo once. He remains one of the greatest examples of human genius I've ever seen over my 21 centuries of life, and one of the bravest. Think of the giant, hairy stones he must have had to stand up to the Catholic Church back when they routinely toppled monarchs and killed people for the glory of their God. Who let me buy him a shot of whiskey in Arizona once, by the way, and who did not feel particularly glorified by any murders, let alone the ones committed in his name? To look at the whole of Christendom and call bullshit on their geocentrism despite their threats took some iron guts. And he didn't give a damn that nobody wanted to believe him at first. "I have math," he told me over the rim of his cup. He gestured to it as he spoke. "And the numbers are like this fine vintage we are enjoying. Verifiable, observable, existing independent of us, and caring not one whit about human faith." Stellar guy, that Galileo. Ha! My puns remain execrable, alas. Eventually, the church had to admit that Galileo was right, and admit also, long after his death, that his life and work had been a fulcrum on which the world pivoted. The flourishing of the sciences that used his methods brought many wonders to humanity. Many evils, too. I am beginning to wonder now if I might not also be such a fulcrum for good and evil, even if I've labored to remain anonymous. I have endeavored for much of my long life to keep myself out of histories, all the while putting more and more history behind me. For much of my 2,000-plus years, I did not feel I was building to some grand climax, or accomplishing anything but my continued survival. But recent events have caused me to reevaluate. According to a nightmarish visit from the Morrigan, Ragnarok will begin in the next few days, and it won't end well for anyone, because apocalypses tend not to include happy endings. Perhaps I can still do something to minimize the damage. No matter what I do, though, it cannot erase the fact that it wouldn't be happening at all had I not slain the Norns and unchained the Norse pantheon from their destinies. I am almost entirely to blame, and the guilt is already a 9-ton albatross about my neck. I don't think I'm going to get an easy gig afterward like Coleridge's Ancient Mariner did either. Telling your tale to random wedding guests is a pretty mild punishment for economy-sized cock-ups. It is fortunate that I have a friend able to shoulder such burdens and make me forget for a while that they're there.
So, tell me more about your plans for this meat and gravy bar, Atticus.
Oberon said as he placed his paws against a bound tree in Tasmania prior to shifting home to Oregon. My Irish wolfhound was expecting a proper feast before I went off to battle gods and monsters and assorted demons from the world's pantheons, and he challenged me to supply a meat bar for him, Orla, and Starbuck, our new Boston Terrier, in the style of salad bar buffets. We'd adopted Starbuck during a stint of crime fighting in Portland that Oberon pompously called the Case of the Purloined Poodle.
Is it going to include all of the meats I will one day include in the Book of Five Meats? Or are you going to just have the traditional stuff?
The five meat categories will be represented, I assured him.
And the gravies? There will be more than one kind, right?
Of course. Didn't you have a maxim about this?
Oh, it's the best line from the Communist Manifesto by that guy Carl that you told me about. From each according to his ability, to each according to his meat.
I think you're misquoting, Oberon. It's supposed to be to each according to his need.
Well, I need that quote to be about meat, Atticus, so I fixed it.
Choosing to keep Oberon carefully insulated from double entendres has proven to be endlessly entertaining. An excellent job, too. It can't possibly be interpreted to mean anything else but what you meant. Here we go. I shifted us home to our cabin near the Mackenzie River in the Willamette National Forest, and Oberon immediately shouted mentally to the other hounds once we arrived.
Hey, Orla, Starbuck, we're home, and guess what? Atticus is going to make us a meat and gravy bar.
Starbuck's higher-pitched voice replied immediately with his limited vocabulary.
Yes, food, he said.
This sounds like one of the best human inventions since the sausage grinder,
Orla added, and both of them exploded through the doggy door to greet us, Orla trailing behind because she was very pregnant and close to delivering. I had to spend a while getting slobbered on and trying to satisfy three dogs with only two hands while they demanded details on the meat and gravy bar. I confessed that I didn't have sufficient information to provide details. Oberon was incredulous.
Okay, Atticus. Wait now. What information are you lacking exactly? Surely you are aware of the basic conditions of houndly existence? All the meats are out there, like the truth is out there, and we want to eat them all? Is that sufficient?
All the meats? Oberon, that's impossible.
Is it, though? Is it?
It is. At least in the time I have allotted to me. Maybe it could be a squad goal for later, but right now we have to limit ourselves to what we can pick up in Eugene. Is Ernest here? Ernest Goggins Smythe was our live-in dog sitter, whom we'd been depending on rather heavily in the past few weeks, especially as Orla's delivery approached. He had a standard poodle named Jack and a boxer named Algernon, or Algie for short, and they'd remained inside with him.
Yeah, he's here,
Orla said. I should probably say hi and make sure he's okay with Jack and Algy participating in this smorgasbord. But after that, would you three like to come with me to Eugene to go shopping for the meats? You can advise me on what to get.
That would be wonderful,
Orla said.
Yes, food!
Starbuck shouted.
I advise you right now to get everything,
Oberon said. Do you want to go or not?
I do. My advice isn't going to change, but I want to smell the wind on the ride over and slobber and shed on your upholstery.
Okay. Give me a minute to talk to Ernest. After confirming that Jack and Algy could participate in at least some cautious, meaty debauchery, my hounds piled into the blue 54 Chevy pickup I'd acquired during an escapade that Oberon had dubbed the Squirrel on the Train. Oberon looked out the back window at the truck bed.
I'm not sure you have enough cargo space for all the meat we're gonna need, Etiquette.
It's more than enough, Oberon.
But leftovers, Etiquette! Leftovers! For the time you'll be gone!
I'm not promising anything at this point beyond an assortment of meats and gravies. And maybe a story about a famous hound for the drive, since you're way too pumped up right now.
Famous hound?
Orla's ears perked up. More of a tiny hound. A beagle, in fact.
Oh, I like beagles, Oberon said. They're good at sniffing out rabbits, and then I can chase them.
What was the hound's name?
Orla asked. It was Bingo.
Oh, like the song about the farmer had a dog?
Exactly like the song. I can tell you the true story of the actual Bingo who inspired that song.
He had a story?
Orla cocked her head at me as we pulled out onto the road. It was crowded in the cab, the hounds barely fit, and Starbuck had to sit on my lap, all a quiver with excitement.
The song just says that Bingo was his name-o, and that's it.
Oh, but there were earlier versions of the song, which hinted some heroic deeds, and I know the details of that heroism. Oberon stopped looking at the truck bed and trying to imagine it filled with meat.
Okay, Atticus, you hooked me. Tell us about Bingo.
In the 18th century, just before the agricultural and industrial revolutions, there was a cabbage farmer in the southern uplands of Scotland. That's the region closest to the border with Britain. His name was Douglas MacTavish, the Gaelic form of Douglas MacTavish. In addition to his hillside of cabbages and a hayfield, he had a barnyard with some animals in there, a dairy cow, a plow horse, and most important, a henhouse. Because chickens, those humble descendants of dinosaurs, are so delicious, they needed protection from foxes. And because cabbages are likewise delicious to some animals, they needed protection from rabbits and the like. That was where Bingo came in. Half his job was to protect the farm, and the other half was to be adorable. Bingo was outstanding at both halves of his job. But he worried about his human. Douglas, you see, had taken to drinking quite a bit of ale after tragedy struck. He lost his wife as she gave birth to their first child, and then lost the child soon after to fever. He was heartbroken and descending into alcoholism, and Bingo worried that he'd never recover. One night, as Douglas was scowling at a potato and cabbage pie he'd made for dinner, a dish called Rumbledy Thumps. Bingo let loose with a tremendous racket outside, and Douglas assumed, quite rightly, that they had an unwelcome visitor. He was already pickled as he grabbed up his musket, which he kept loaded and primed in case of emergencies like this one. There was a fox trying to get into the henhouse, and Bingo was chasing him off headed toward the property of the neighboring farm. They had a stile over the fence, for they were good neighbors, and the fox actually used the stile, and Bingo leapt after him. That was the first verse of the original song. The farmer's dog leapt over the stile. His name was Little Bingo. The second verse had to do with the farmer's drinking habit, and that was immortalized because Douglas was inebriated to the point where he shouldn't be attempting things like steep steps over a fence. He managed to climb up to the top okay, but coming down was disastrous. He slipped on the first step, fired the musket into the air with a convulsive jerk of the trigger, and wound up hitting his head on the bottom step pretty badly. He was unconscious and bleeding. Well, Bingo left off chasing that fox right away when he heard that gunshot and realized his human had stopped hollering. He ran back to Douglas and tried to wake him up, even slobbered on his nose, but it was no good. So he hightailed it to that other farmhouse and barked his head off until some humans came out, and then he kept running back and forth until they got the idea he wanted to show them something. They followed Bingo to Douglas and brought him inside and cleaned him up, bandaged his head. These were the Mayfields, and at that time a cousin of theirs was visiting, young Kimberly Mayfield, and she thought Douglas handsome and Bingo adorable. She gave Bingo some sausage topped with gravy, in fact, for being such a good hound. And when Douglas woke up, he found Kimberly to be kind and beautiful and clearly well-loved by his dog, so there was no hope for it. He fell in love again. The next verse of the old song went like this. The farmer loved a pretty young lass and gave her a wedding ring, oh. And it provides few details after that, but he also stopped drinking and became his old happy self again. So that's why Bingo got immortalized in song. He protected the delicious chickens, saved his human's life, and helped him find love once more. But much of the original story's been lost over time, until we have the bare bones song that children sing and clap to today. Orla had questions.
How do you know all this? Did you know Douglas?
No. I met his son, one he had with Kimberly, years later in America. Lots of farmers came across the ocean during the lowland clearances, as they call it now.
Adicus, I'm seeing some pretty significant parallels here,
Oberon said. You are?
Well, yeah. I'm good at protecting you, and I'm also very handsome, right, Orla?
He's right, Atticus. He is very handsome.
See? I'm just like Bingo. Except I don't have a song about me yet, and I think that's a gross oversight. Maybe we can make one.
Maybe. How would it go?
There was a hound named Oberon, and he loved sausage gravy. G-R-A-V-Y, G-R-A-V-Y, G-R-A-V-Y. And he loves sausage gravy. Yes, food,
Starbuck said by way of applause. They amused themselves by making up additional verses and then taking turns sticking their heads out the window for the rest of the drive. When we got into Eugene, the hounds agreed to stay in the bed of the truck while I went to get the meats and necessary gravy ingredients. I sent them mental pictures of what was available, and they chose what they wanted, and I did make them choose instead of buying everything. That was for practical reasons. I didn't have all the time or sufficient kitchen space to make everything. But I did want to spend some time giving them a memorable meal, since I didn't know when I'd next be able to come home. I lost some time staring at the ground beef packaged in red undulating waves, realizing that I might never come home and might lie somewhere beyond the aid of my soul catcher charm to help, food for worms, packed up in some skin instead of styrofoam and cellophane, but otherwise little different from the 90% lean on sale. Oberon had made clear that he wanted to go with me, regardless of the danger, but I told him I couldn't bear it if he was hurt. I needed a home to come back to. I teared up at the mere thought of him living without me or me without him. We'd be so lonesome and hangdog, not to put too fine a point on it. And neither of us would be thinking of a feast like this. We'd probably not want to eat at all without the other one around to enjoy it with.
Radicus, there may be a slight drool problem developing in the truck,
Oberon said, interrupting my maudlin reverie.
You might want to pick up a roll of those paper towels, the super absorbent kind. Hurry up.
I have puppies to feed, you know,
Orla added. They really are the best hounds. Ernest pitched in once we got home, and we had 5 hounds underfoot in the kitchen until I demanded that they vacate to the perimeter, where they could slobber and comment on the smells without tripping us up. We had a pot roast going, Cornish hens roasting, dry cured sausages to slice, ribs on the grill, and four different gravies simmering on the stovetop. We had fish cooking in lime juice for a ceviche, too. Swordfish steaks sharing grill space next to the ribs, and charcuterie sliced thinly and layered on cedar planks. When it was ready, we set it all out on the dining room table, lacking an actual bar, and put the gravies in tureens. Ernest and I had the hounds sit before it, their hungry excitement plain, and took some pictures. We then fixed each hound a plate, giving them the option to choose, but knowing they'd try everything once and then come back for seconds of whatever they liked best.
Oh, wow, Vaticus, this is just the best day of food ever,
Orla said.
I agree, yes! There was that bison bonanza we had one time in South Dakota, but this even tops that.
Yes, food,
Starbuck chimed in. Cleanup was a major chore, but Ernest and I got it done, and I managed to catch a few hours of sleep before giving them lazy belly rubs in the wee hours of the morning and kissing them on the head and telling them they were loved. I slipped out the back door, relieved to know that they were safe as I began to work on cleaning up my mess. I had a 9-ton albatross about my neck to remove. The Morrigan had been less than specific during her visit to me. She'd said only that Loki was going to act soon, but hadn't said precisely when or where. I needed more details to counter him effectively, and I knew precisely where to get them. Casting wands wasn't going to get me the specifics I needed. I needed a seer without peer who could read details in the future. Makira, the Tyromancer, had helped me on a couple of occasions before, and I hoped she could do so again. She had most recently been living on Evna Bloch, one of the 9 Irish plains, and nominally ruled by Munnan and MacLear, since I'd helped her escape from the attentions of some vampires. That threat was over now, the vampires in question all sent to their final deaths, and she could return to Earth if she wished. She certainly wished it. She looked a bit harried when I found her. What's the matter?
There are ghosts here. I mean, they've arrived recently. Very strange.
Are they attacking you?
No, but they don't need to attack to creep me out.
It might be because Munnan and MacLear has given up on his duties as psychopomp. The Morrigan has as well, so the dead are going wherever they can instead of where they should.
Well, I want out.
I've come to offer that very thing. And ask for a cheese. Her shoulders slumped.
Of course you have. What is it you want to know this time?
I've been told Ragnarok is about to begin. I'd like to know precisely when and where the first attacks will occur.
All right,
she replied, her voice deadpan.
Something nice and light as usual. Where did they make great cheese these days?
I shrugged. Lots of places. How does France sound? Ever been there? Makira's face lit up.
Ah, the fromage of the French. Let's go there. I think I'd like to learn from them, and maybe teach them a thing or two.
I helped her gather her few belongings, and we shifted to a small stand of trees outside Poitiers, in the goat cheese region of France. Makira might prefer a different region in the end, but I thought the area winsome, and it would be a good place to find what she needed without the madness of Paris to deal with. She was used to being a hermit, after all. Poitiers might be a mighty shock to her system as it was.
My French is somewhat rusty. Perhaps very rusty.
It'll come back to you. And you'll be able to get along in the meantime with English.
You think?
She looked doubtful as her gaze wandered around the streets. We were heading for a supermarket where she could purchase some basics for cheesemaking.
I don't see anyone who looks like me. This might have been a bad idea.
I grinned because I expected her to have second thoughts. Let's go to the store and make a cheese, at least. If you don't feel more comfortable by the end, I'll take you elsewhere. Makira agreed to this, her eyes darting around and her arms hugging herself. Once inside the store, however, with a basket in her hand, some of her social anxiety drained away as her professional interests took hold and she searched for ingredients. She also noted the faces of some other shoppers who weren't white, and she exchanged tight nods and smiles with them as she passed. But at the dairy case, she had cause to do more than that. She had pulled a few quarts of goat milk out of the refrigerator and turned to discover a woman dressed much like her, in Eritrean fashion, wearing a light tunic with a gold and black embroidered neckline that then fell in a vertical line down the center to her midriff. Makira's was embroidered in blues and blacks, but otherwise they were almost identical. Recognition flared in their eyes. The other woman, whose skin was a deep umber with cool undertones like Makira's, spoke first.
"Are you from Eritrea?"
she asked in French.
"Oui,"
Makira said.
"Vous?"
The newcomer responded affirmatively and flashed a brilliant smile. Then they promptly switched to their native language, which I did not speak. I stepped away out of Makira's sight so that she would not feel she had to introduce me. That worked perfectly. She forgot all about me, so excited to meet someone from Eritrea this far from home. As the conversation extended and I pretended to read the ingredients of some crackers nearby, I thought I detected something in their voices and risked a peek at their auras. Yep, a touch of arousal there. They were into each other. Cool. The other woman asked a question that startled Makira into remembering that she hadn't come alone. She looked around for me and I gave her a tiny wave. Somewhat abashed, she introduced me as her friend Connor Malloy. Her new acquaintance introduced herself as Fiori.
"Pleasure to meet you," I said in French. "Please take your time chatting, I'm in no hurry."
I backed away again and chose to make a more thorough examination of the crackers. Some while later, Makira found me, her face shining with joy.
"Fiori gave me her phone number. You know what this means."
"She likes you."
"No, I mean yes, but it means I need to get a phone."
"I agree. Let's do that and get you set up." We took our purchases to an extended stay hotel with a kitchenette and rented it for a month. The unspoken understood agreement we had was that I get Makira started here, or anywhere, in exchange for her tyromancy. That would give her time to get her assets transferred and find something a bit more permanent. I did my best not to pace or look impatient as Makira set about making a soft goat cheese. As the world's finest tyromancer, she would be able to see details of the future in the patterns of its curdling and coagulation, far more accurately than any divination I could practice. I wrote down a single question for, though it was composed of many parts. When she was ready for it, she read it aloud.
"When and where will Loki, Hel, and Jormungandr appear to begin Ragnarok?"
She gave a tiny shake of her head and sighed.
"All right, here we go."
She squinted at the goat milk in her stainless steel pot as she added rennet and it began to posset and curd. I had a hotel pad and pen ready to go.
"Jormungandr first, off a small peninsula south of Skibbereen, near one of those foothills."
"When?"
"Thursday morning is the best I can do."
"Thursday. Thor's Day. Of course Loki would choose to begin then. That was only 3 days away. And the others?"
"Loki and Hel will appear together the same day, in mid-afternoon, but up in Sweden, the northern edge of a lake."
"I know the place. Yggdrasil's root is bound there." "Damn. I need to make some calls."
"And I need a phone,"
Makira reminded me,
"so I can make a call myself."
"Right. I'll go get you a burner phone. Be right back." It didn't take long to find a convenience store that sold burner phones. Once I got one and activated it for, I gave it to Makira with my thanks and best wishes. "Call Fiori soon," I said.
"Why?"
"Because she likes you, and because of Thursday. I'm gonna do my best, Makira, but it might not work out well. Don't start any cheeses that need to age."
"That's not funny, my friend."
"No. No, it's not."
Chapter 2. If you give the world half a chance, it'll turn to shite. We knew that thousands of years ago, but Sheehan tells me there's a fancy law about it now. Kind of like if you have a basic cracker, and you feel okay about it. But put some feckin' nasty fish eggs on top and call it caviar. Now it's fancy. The fancy law is the second law of thermodynamics, and it says if you have an isolated system, then entropy will increase and, goddammit, let's just say things turn to shite and be done with it, all right? We can call it the first law of Owen. Except that you can clean up the shite if you have the heart and mind for it. Call that the second law of Owen. And I'm proud of me apprentices right now for the work they're doing. We're in Tasmania, saving some marsupial dog-like creatures called devils. They got a strange transmissible face cancer back in the 90s, and it was wiping them out. But now our job is to wipe out that cancer, finding every devil on the island and curing them one by one. The apprentices have Tasmanite spheres from Tasmania in the lockets I made them, and the elemental uses that to channel energy through them, which allows them to hear the devils, even though they're far from being proper druids yet. Tasmania doesn't think we can wait, and I'm on board with the idea. I'm thinking these new druids will be Gaia's healers above all else, fighting centuries of humans turning everything to shite. I wonder if they have a fancy law or name for the principle that humans ruin everything for profit. Maybe that's just capitalism. Regardless, it's going to take generations of druids to undo all this damage. Greta's with me, and so are most of the kids' parents, and we're all feeling pretty good about what we're doing to help. Watching the wee ones heal Tasmanian devils makes me think everything can be healed, somehow. Perhaps there's a way to heal the breach between Fand and Breit, so we don't have to have any more war among the Fae. And maybe we can smooth things over between the Fae and Sheehan. Less likely, I figure, since he's still a feckin' iron druid. But I'd settle for healing the breach between him and Greta. Sheehan is here in Tasmania too, on the same mission as we are, but somewhere else at the moment. At least Greta didn't try to kill him when we met up for a brief while. She's got more acid for him than spent coffee grounds have for me garden soil. But maybe in a season or three, she'll mellow out like a teacher lapping up medicinal bourbon after school. I'm going to give it time. We've found a den with 5 afflicted devils in it. One of them is near death as you can be without stepping over the line. I take care of that one, and the apprentices work on the others. We're almost finished when Greta tells me someone's coming. There's a whisper among the ferns underneath the eucalyptus. Since we're away from any settlement, I'm thinking it must be a hiker or hunter, but it's neither. It's Breit, first among the Fae, come to find me. She's all armoured up for some reason, red hair, spilling over the pauldrons, and it sits me on edge. Where's the fight she's dressed for? I hope it's not with me. There's a fairy with her. The tall, slim sort you see in underwear advertisements, who always look bored with being so handsome and desirable and minimally dressed. Except he is dressed, all spiffy, in his silver and green court livery, with high thread count and a powdered wig with curls on the sides of his head. Without even turning on me true vision, I can feel he's covered in magical wards, even more powerful than Breit's. Well met, Owen O'Kennedy, she says, nodding once to me. We'll meet Breit. The first among the Fae gestures to her right. This is Coriander, Herald Extraordinary of the 9 Fae Plains. I'm not sure why she puts the adjective after the noun in his title. Maybe it's to make him sound as fancy as he looks. I nod at him. How are you, Cory? I'm Owen. He gives me a bow, dripping with excess manners, and says in a mild musical lilt, "So pleased to meet you, sir. I prefer to be called Coriander, if you please." If that's his preference, then I'm already suspicious we may not be the best of friends. I introduce Greta and me apprentices to Breit and sort of wave at the parents as a group. She takes note of the apprentices and says they'll need to undergo the Buella Croton soon. "But I've come here on urgent business," she says. "May we draw aside and speak in private?" "Of course," I ask, "Tuya, my youngest apprentice, to finish up healing the devil I'd been working on, and tell them all I'll return soon." Briette and I step into the undergrowth, and the herald extraordinary floats about 3 steps behind.
"It has come to my attention," Briette says, "that one of the Norse gods intends to begin his pantheon's version of Apocalypse. They call it Ragnarok. Are you familiar with it?"
"Oi, Sheahan caught me up on all that bollocks."
"It poses a serious threat to us. Should they harm a significant portion of our Irish population, we will suffer a similar reduction in our powers, and tethers to Tir na n'Og and other plains may be severed."
"So it's back to defend the homeland, eh?"
"Yes. But we alone may not be sufficient. We need all the Fae to participate. We need all the Tuatha De Danann too."
"Ye mean we need Fand and Munnan and MacLair?"
"Correct. Sheahan tells me she's in the Morrigan's Fen."
"Aye, I heard the same."
"It is my opinion, Owen, that only you can mend the rift between us."
"I was thinking someone ought to be mending rifts, but I didn't think I'd have any part in it. I'm rather the sort to create rifts."
"She will not speak to me or Sheahan. We are corrupted by iron, both in her eyes and the eyes of all the Fae who follow her. She cannot listen to us, or she will lose face among them. But you are of the old ways and have enjoyed their hospitality in the past. You will at least gain an audience."
"Forgive me, Briette, but I don't think so. All those Fae and the Morrigan's human will cut me down before I can even flash me teeth at Fand."
"That is why I am sending Coriander with you. No one will harm him or dare touch anyone under his protection."
"His protection?" I glance back at the bewigged fairy and wonder if he can even protect his own sack from a swift kick. Briette catches this and smiles.
"By all means, Owen, feel free to test his defences if it'll ease your doubts."
"What? You mean punch him in the nose or something?"
"Whatever you wish."
Briette stops walking and gestures at the herald.
"Do go ahead."
"Can I use me knuckles?" I asks her, and she hesitates.
"I would not recommend it. Start with your bare fists, or feet."
I squint at the fancy herald. "Are ye all right with this lad?"
"Of course, good sir. I hope you will not be injured too badly."
Their unworried confidence shakes me own, and I go ahead and check out the herald in the magical spectrum. He shimmers with layers of protective wards, among them a kinetic one of a strength and weave I've never seen before. "Shrivel me cock, lad, who gave ye such wards?"
"Most of the Tuatha De Danann have contributed in one way or another. I represent a group effort. I cannot be harmed or deliver harm except to redirect that aimed at me. I am therefore allowed everywhere in the Nine Plains, since I cannot be used for treacherous purposes."
"I see. And should the human take it into their wee woody noggins that I'm to be skewered sideways, ye can prevent them from doing that?"
"So long as I remain between you."
"Ah, so beware me flanks then."
"Precisely."
I turn back to Briette. "All right. If I go, how do you suggest I get her to cooperate?"
"You may relay an offer I think she will find attractive, if she be not mad."
"And once she gives me the details, I asks when I must go."
"Now, Owen, I will bind this eucalyptus to Tir na n'Og while you make your farewells."
"But the devils
will still exist should we prevail. Nothing will remain if we fail."
"Ah, thank you for the perspective. And have ye spoken to Sheahan about this? He's on the island somewhere."
"No longer. He heard from the Morrigan and is pursuing different objectives. We used a tree he bound to shift in and had to travel here at speed over land.
You may rest assured that Grunuel will be involved as well.
Right then. I'll be back soon. Excuse me. Greta waits for me, arms crossed and her neck taut with stress as she searches me face.
Damn it,
she says.
You're leaving us here, aren't you? I can tell already.
I have to, love, though I'd rather not.
You don't have a choice.
Not if I want to keep my honor intact. She growls at me.
To hell with honor. That's the kind of thinking that gets people killed. Gunner's dead because of his sense of honor, and Hal's dead because of someone else's sense of honor. I don't want you dying for the same reason. I'd rather have you intact than your honor.
Not sure if I can stay physically intact if I don't also protect me honor in this case. We have to go see Fand and convince her to help us fight off Loki. Ragnarok's coming, love. It's not the sort of thing he sit back and watch and hope someone else takes care of it all. She snorts in disbelief, then stops breathing.
You're serious? You're talking about the end of the world?
Let's hope it won't be. But yes, it's what Loki wants.
Where are you going?
To the Morgans, Finn. After that, I'm not sure. But I'll come back here to finish this job when I can. You can either stay here and watch over the kids, they have the knack for it now, or you can pack up and fly back to the States. We surely don't know which is safer.
Okay, we'll decide later.
I bid farewell to the apprentices and their parents, and tell them to keep up their fine work, and spend a little bit of time with each apprentice. Tandy worries she'll forget everything when I'm gone, because she finds something to worry about in every situation. Her father, Songkwe, is so patient and kind with her that I think this must be a recent behavior caused by her mother leaving them. She will see her strength soon enough. Oscar will be fine so long as his parents are all right. He checks on them to see how they're handling my leaving, and since they seem unconcerned, he simply tells me to be safe, and they'll do the same. Tuya asks me if she's going to get to learn any more about the plants while I'm gone. Healing devils is fine, but she's really fascinated by flowers and trees and growing things. Of course, I says to her. Remember that you can talk to Tasmania any time you wish through your sphere there. I point to the locket around her neck. Ask the elemental about its favorite plants, and I'm sure you'll learn all you ever wanted to know. Did you know that there are plants here that eat bugs?
Really?
Sandews, for sure. Perhaps many more. Ask about them.
I will.
Mehdi, a solemn boy from Morocco, assures me that he and his father will pray for my safe return.
We will work hard while you're away,
he adds. Amita hears this and nods.
We will heal as many devils as we can.
She's already the sort of person who works tirelessly at a goal once she's been given one. She's going to be a powerful champion of Gaia when she grows up. Luis, me animal lover, doesn't care at all that I'm leaving.
What? Oh, bye,
he says. Then he whips his head around.
Wait, we don't have to stop healing devils while you're gone, do we?
No, lad, ye can keep at it.
Good. I love this.
He flashes a gap-toothed grin at me before turning his attention back to the devil he's healing, and I'm already forgotten. Me farewells to the apprentices finished, Greta grabs me by the face, both hands in me beard, and leans her forehead against mine.
You come back to me, teddy bear.
You can be sure that's the plan, love. I really don't want to leave her, or any of them. This bollocks sounds like the kind of fool thing Sheehan keeps getting involved in. Maybe this is what it's gonna be like now. Being one of the few druids left instead of one of the many. Everything's an emergency. I give Greta the sort of kiss that says I want to pick up where we left off, and I promise a good run through the forest when I'm back. Briat is just finishing up when I rejoin them. All right, Andy, I says to the herald. Let's go!
It's coriander, sir?
I grin at him. A four-syllable name is impractical in battle, lad, and in most poetry, too. If ye care about what the bards say, I'll give ye only two syllables until ye actually save me bones from the fae. You can pick. Corey? Ian? Hendy? Gobshite? I don't care. What'll it be?
Coriander, sir?
He shoots a pleading glance at Brit, but she looks amused, and I laugh at him. How about fuckstick? Aye, that'll do. He doesn't have a word against me calling him the wrong name. I know it makes me a feckin' arsehole, but he's a far sight more smug than I can stand. And besides, I have to carve off what wee slices of amusement I can from this situation. I'm pretty sure the first law of Owen is about to enforce itself.
Chapter 3. Last week, a vampire exploded in my bar in Warsaw. Not spontaneously. I unbound his undead ass because he came in to threaten me, and he went sploosh in a spectacular fashion. People screamed and panicked. One of my regulars thought it was so metal, though, and he's become one of my favorite people. I give him free shots of Zubrovka with his beers now. Much of the vampire's remains landed in his pudding and kind of ruined his nice leather jacket, but he just snapped pictures of the gore for his Instagram. Since Atticus and Owen are in Tasmania helping out the elemental there, I'm pretty much on my own, at least during the day, enforcing the treaty with the vampires. Specifically the part where it says all vampires need to be out of Poland in order to keep a promise Atticus made to the Sisters of the Three Auroras. A vampire older than Leif Helgerson by the name of Kacper Głowa emerged in Krakow and said he wasn't going to leave, and neither were the rest of the vampires. So he's thumbing his pale boogerless nose at both the druids and at Leif. I don't know. Do vampires have boogers? Leif finally admitted that they sorta kinda poop, or more accurately, excrete in the most disgusting fashion possible. But maybe I'm assuming too much on the booger front. Leif is helping me with the problem, and we did clear out a nest in Krakow, taking out 12 of those suckers. But Głowa wasn't among them, even though it was his property. Leif thinks if we take out old Kacper, the rest will fall in line and leave the country. All we have to do is find him, which is proving difficult because you can't divine the dead, and he's old and rich and very, very good at hiding. So I'm back at work at Browar Szóstej Dzielnica in Warsaw, even though I was shot in that nest raid a few days ago, because we're hoping he'll try to come after me, or at least send a minion we can hopefully trace back to him. Who comes to visit me instead? A decidedly dejected member of the Tua de Danann, looking out of place in hunting leathers with a bow strapped to her back. She sits down at the bar next to my metal regular, Maciej, drawing stares from pretty much everyone since she appears to be cosplaying for a Renaissance festival. Well, that, and she's a red-haired goddess renowned for her sexual appetites. She kind of projects an irresistible vibe, and the stares are mostly of the wanton and lusty sort. Maciej is too startled to feel much else but surprise, however.
Oh, hey,
he says in Polish, which I'm pretty sure Flittish doesn't speak.
You have tattoos like Granuel has, or used to have.
The Polish word for tattoos is almost identical to English, and that, combined with his pointing to her druidic tats and then my arm, is enough for Flittish to piece it together.
Yes, hello. My tattoos are like hers,
she says in English, then her eyes turn to me.
Hello, Granuel. Would you... Wait, what happened to your tattoos?
I don't respond in English because it wouldn't do to have Maciej here. I use Old Irish instead. Welcome, Flittish. I still have them. They're just under a nice magical cloak that the Sisters of the Three Auroras gave me. I got too many comments about them, and it was distracting.
You two could be sisters,
Maciej says, switching to his accented English.
Are you sisters?
I can see Flittish getting annoyed and think perhaps I should defuse that before she acts on the violence in her head. Pardon me a moment, Flittish, I say to her. I'm just going to explain who you are. I switch to Polish for Maciej's benefit, and also so I can speak frankly to him about the mortal peril he's in. He needs to know that Flitish is not my sister, and she will most likely mess somebody up, and I don't want him to be on the receiving end. I hope my grasp of the language is up to the task. It's much improved, but I'm not sure it's solid.
Zaglądamy podamnie, a nie jest moje sostro. Ma na imię Flitish I jest naprawdę niebezpieczna, mój wiesario. Zobaczysz, potrafi naprawdę zepsuć. Człowiekowi cieni, kidaktka cio w koza, żebyś to byta dobra?
Maciej agrees, but asks for clarification.
Dobra, wiz mamzy nie w ogóle nie gadać?
I confirm that for him, continuing in Polish. It's safer if you don't say anything. Enjoy your drink, it's on me, all right? And let someone else make the mistake? Just tell her right now it's an honor to meet her, because it is, and ask her to forgive your interruption. Trust me. Maciej nods quickly, his long hair flowing around his head like he's rocking out to Trivium or Hammerfall. He does trust me, and I like to think it's not just because I give him free booze sometimes. He turns to the Irish goddess of the hunt and speaks slowly in his best English.
It's an honor to meet you, Flitish. Please pardon my interruption.
Flitish's expression mellows from hostility to only mild disdain.
I appreciate your courtesy, mortal.
Mortal?
I shake my head at Maciej vehemently, and he gets the message not to pursue that. Flitish ignores his question, fortunately, and just talks right over him.
Please pardon me while I talk to Grunuel for a while.
Of course,
Maciej says.
Please.
Flitish awards him a brilliant smile for his compliance, and I beam at him also. He blushes a little bit, and then looks down politely. I breathe a sigh of relief. That could have gone wrong so quickly for him. What can I get for you, Flitish? I ask.
Whatever you have that's closest to something Govnu would have brewed, she says.
I almost ask her short or tall, but catch myself just in time. She's an Irish goddess. If I give her a tiny glass of beer, she will hurt me. Instead, I merely nod and pull her a true imperial pint of my favorite local brew, a thick oatmeal stout with chocolate notes and a clever bit of mint thrown in. There we are, I say, and set it down on top of a coaster. It's great to see you. To what do I owe the honor?
I have a message for you from Briet, but that can wait. This can't.
She picks up the 20 ounces of stout and chugs the whole thing in one go. By the end of it, both Maciej and I have our mouths open in awe.
Ah,
Flitish says, thunking the empty glass down on the bar, a thin mustache of foam on her upper lip.
That was surprisingly satisfactory. Another?
She meets my green eyes with hers, and I recognize the expression from the mirror whenever I feel like I could kill something. Oh, shit. Something's up. I take her glass, place it in the sink, and fetch her a fresh chilled one, pulling another pint. She quaffs it just like the first, and demands a third. Maciej looks like he might be falling in love just a little bit. If it were anyone else, I would have said no. I would have been required to say no. 40 ounces of beer in 2 minutes was going to hit her hard pretty soon. And it's not like this was some watered-down, mass-produced American swill. That stout has a beefy 11.2% ABV. But, like me, Flitish can heal the poison of alcohol any time she wishes. She must therefore be drinking for a purpose, and has come to me to help her achieve it. My duty is clear, but drunken deities are rather infamous for collateral damage. I don't want to see Maciej or anyone really get hurt over whatever's bothering her. And that could be almost anything these days, what with the turmoil going on in the Fey Plains. Normally, Flitish is a hardcore soldier type, based both on what I've seen and what Atticus has told me. She's intensely loyal to Briet, even taking Briet's side against her own daughter, Fand. But she has a mercurial disposition, and any reading of her emotions you take in one instant can be null and void the next. Atticus says the thing about Flitish is you never know whether she's going to want to fight or fuck. Sometimes he says it's both. You simply have to tread carefully, mind your manners, and be prepared for either. So, I say to her as I put the third pint down and then switch languages again to Old Irish, so that we can talk in front of Maciej in complete privacy. If I had to guess, I'd say the two of us are currently the only speakers of that language in all of Poland. Tell me, in the old tongue, just between us druids, if you're in the mood to share, that is, what troubles you? I count 9 seconds of intense glaring before Flidish replies.
I will tell you, even though you're young and unprepared. Men.